Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a bird, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. They never will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and on the air.
We are live from upstate New York, and it is freezing outside, but it's going to be really fun and sunny in here. We've got award-winning author Matt Quayle. We're going to talk about Wrong Light, and I am so excited. Image is everything to some people. What about when one seen or heard the public is false? What happens when the world sees is it really a facade created to hide secrets, lies, and fears you want to stay buried? Naomi Hendricks is a talk show host on a nightly show and does not realize as yet she's being followed and inadvertently threatened. And author Matt Quayle is going to tell us more. Good morning. How are you? And I am so excited that we're finally there.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yep. So tell us a little bit about Rick Cahill and how you created him and why he was thrown off the police force.
Rick Cahill is now he's a private investigator, but let's see, when this book starts, it's 13 years ago, he was a cop up in Santa Barbara. He's in San Diego now. He was a young cop in Santa Barbara, married, and his wife was murdered, and he was arrested for the murder, but never went to trial. He was released, but thought by the Santa Barbara Police Department to be a guy who got away with murder. And in fact, many people in the country feel that way because there was a 48-hour, you know, the 48 hours true crime show. They did an episode on his wife's murder not too long after she died and made it look like he was guilty there. So he was eventually kicked off the force in Santa Barbara, went back to his hometown of San Diego, who initially managed a restaurant, and then he became a private investigator after about a year. After, in the first book, Yesterday's Echo, helping a woman in a dire situation, that kind of got his juices flowing to back to trying to help people, and the only way he knew how was that be a private investigator.
Well, the first book I read of yours, and it came, like I said, out of nowhere, like this one did, was Blood Truth. That was really good. So in that one, I got to know him and his father. So tell us about why he was sort of estranged from his father and how he became friends with one of my favorite characters that you can't kill off, Moira. Seriously. I love her.
His father was a police officer in a town in San Diego called La Jolla. And for years, he was revered as a great cop, but then he was thought to be embroiled in with the local mob, and he eventually was kind of quietly kicked off the police force, but he spiraled into alcoholism and an early death. And Rick, after you know, revering his father for so many years, had a bad relationship with him at the end, and felt wondered in Blood Truth if, after his own demise from the police force, that perhaps he was truly his father's son, not only by what he'd done, but by, you know, DNA and blood and all that. And was he destined to be like his father? And he ends up in that book discovering the truth about his father. I won't go any further into detail in case people want to read it.
No, they can't. And somebody
Moira.
She's so like me. It's scary. I love Moira.
I brought her in. She was in her first appearance was in the second book, Night Tremors, where Rick had been asked to investigate a case, and unknowingly, him saying yes, he would do it, had meant that she had gotten fired from the case because he didn't know that she was hired before him, and she finds out where he lives, knocks on his front door, and starts chewing him out, and he goes, hey, wait a second. And he's kind of intrigued by this little sawed-off a private eye full of piss and vinegar and very smart. But they actually end up working that case together a little bit. And so I had her in the next book, Dark Fishers, where I just, because Rick's got such a bad reputation with the police forces, he can't really get any inside help when he needs it. So he goes to Moira. So she was in that book for just a couple of phone calls where he needed some information. And then in Blood Truth, book number 4, I was going to have her for one scene where Rick needed her to help him in one scene. And I put her in the scene, and then she said something evocative. And I thought, well, I can't waste her. And then she became a huge part of the book, and to me became kind of the conscience of the book, and very important to Rick to kind of, she's kind of like a four-sided figure where Rick is only three sides. Sometimes he lets his emotions get the better of him. And he knows that he likes her, of course, but he knows he needs her to kind of round him out. And he plus she's smarter than he is and a better private investigator. So he often teams with her for help. And she feels about him that, I don't know why, but because this guy is so kind of broken, she's kind of like a big sister to him where he needs direction, and she tries to help with that. And so she's in quite a bit in Wrong Light. She helps him investigate in Wrong Light as well. And I love writing her.
I love her. I know. I love reading her. And I like this. This was really good. And like I said, I don't remember if it was Autumn or David. One of them sent it, and I go like, here we go again. I'm going to pick up this book, and it's going to stare at me. That's what happened with yesterday's news with Dick Belsky. It was like the book was staring at me. I go like, it's about time you read me. And, yeah, I've got his new one, and I've got D.P. Lyle's new one, too. So, who asked him to protect Naomi, and why no police? I mean, seriously, she was so elusive, this one. She didn't even realize what was happening after a while.
Naomi is, I think you touched about it a little bit in the intro, but Naomi is a, she's kind of a breakout star for this talk radio station where they've never had a star before. So she's really put them on the map. She gets 4 to 5 times the rating of any other of their personalities. So there's a stalker who's kind of harassing her, but she doesn't really know it because she's got, you know, her producer reads her mail, and she's kind of kept away from some of this stuff because they're in the middle of negotiating her next contract, and obviously the station doesn't want to lose her, and they don't want her to know that, you know, bad things are potentially going on. But the police don't get involved because they don't feel there's quite enough there in this letter that they've read to for them to be able to do anything. So the station hires Rick. Rick kind of has a sense for the dark side. He thinks this Pluto character is starting to really escalate. So he takes the case, but he doesn't want to take the case without Naomi knowing, and that creates a little rift between him and the station.
Yeah, and he's pretty risque with this too. He won't say why. So, who are the other people at 1350? And what happens when there were CCTV tapes all over the place. So what happens when he wants the tapes? And who helps him at first? Because he needs outside help. I mean, he needs to be able to access the tapes. So sometimes people don't want to give them without a warrant or something like that.
Well, the station manager, or what's the term for it? Anyway, the guy in control, the programming director, is I'm actually blanking out on his name. I wrote the book a year ago, you know, or actually over a year ago. You forget these things. Chip. His name's. I'm trying to grab the book.
Chip
so
Evigan.
His name.
That's Chip Evigan.
Chip. Right. So he's the station manager, program director, who was a one-time on-air personality himself, and he kind of feels like he's the guy that found the golden goose, and he's although a little bit probably jealous of Naomi's ability and her quick rise after because being an on-air personality himself at one point, but he's got a little bit of a crush on her, but he feels that if she flees the station that he'll kind of be outed as maybe just a guy who got lucky by landing her in the first place. So he's very protective of her, but also protective of his own reputation. And then her producer, Carl, is protective of her because he likes her. He cares about her. So he ends up helping Rick in ways that Rick actually has to. There's also, of course, the owners in the station who are unseen but making decisions. So Rick kind of gets Carl and even reluctantly Chip these tapes because he wants to hear the a call that this Pluto has made into Naomi, kind of a menacing call as the story progresses, that Rick wants to listen over and over again to be able to kind of find the hidden message in what he's saying on the radio.
You know, it's funny because that's why I don't have call-ins, because I used to get crazy call-ins. But seriously, and I don't have a chat room because I was interviewing Jeffrey Wells and I got some really strange people in the chat room. And I said, if you don't like my show, kindly disconnect because I don't really care. They didn't like the topic. And I really didn't care whether they liked it. And Blog Talk, by the way, people, this show is being monitored and recorded. They do record everything. And they do listen back sometimes. And they do said that I could have just sent them, you know, the email or the login numbers. And they probably would have figured out a different one. So it didn't matter. So that's why the show is private and I put it out after. It's so much easier than going crazy. But, yeah.
I think we're in kind of a dangerous time with anonymity where you got it on Twitter where, you know, people attack viciously and
I know.
I don't know. There's just this feeling you can say or do anything and threaten people without any repercussions. It's kind of a scary time that way.
It's scary. I mean, I only had one incident where I won't say which who he is. On a website, on my Facebook wall, and the guy said, your reviews are really good, but I don't like them because they're too long. I said, I have the solution. Don't read them. And I was like, okay. I said, what do you write reviews? And I read his reviews. I said, yours are interesting, and they don't make sense, and they're too short. I said, so we could play a game where you could just stay out of my life, and I promise to stay out of yours, and it's better that way. A lot of people on that particular group that I just, you know, disenrolled from that, you know, said, you're really good, but we'd like to do our reviews this way. I said, well, you know what? Every reviewer has their own unique style, and too bad if you don't like it, because I don't care. So he's got a private investigator's license, but only gets him in so way. My other favorite character was FBI Agent Malin. Why does he help him? I mean, he could get in trouble, too, but I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, let's see. John Malin came in. He was in Dark Fishers, the first book I introduced him, and he became he's kind of an altruistic character. He was an accountant and joined the FBI after his brother was killed overseas by a bomb made by terrorists. Obviously, so he felt John Malin felt he needed to join the FBI to try to track the money that terrorists get to kill people who his brother he thought was a hero, and obviously to help his country. So he helped Rick in ways and Dark Fishers. And then off screen before this book, Rick has helped him with he thinks his wife, John Malin, he thinks his wife was having an affair, and he hires Rick on the sly, obviously, to investigate, and his wife wasn't having an affair at all, actually. But because of that, Rick kind of asks for his help for something. For one reason, he appeals to his sense of helping someone, and also kind of holds over his head, hey, I helped you that time with your wife. See, Rick himself is always trying to do what the ultimate goal is to do the right thing, find the truth in the matter. But sometimes the way he gets there is not really the best way. Sometimes he cuts corners, and especially as the books progress, because of this kind of manic need to find the truth. So when he should be making friends, sometimes he creates sort of enemies.
A lot of people do, though, seriously.
Yeah.
And sometimes your enemies become your best friends. You just don't know it, right? You never know.
Oh, yeah.
But so, how come you decided, and this is really exciting because as a radio host, it's really cool, when somebody decides to make a radio show, the focal point of the story, how come you decided on that particular topic? And yet you have another theme that it's not part of your question, but there's still another plot. There's like a double plot in this one, right?
Yeah. I've listened to talk radio for years and years, going way back, maybe 30 years ago, when it was different now. Now it's all politics or sports or conspiracy theories. And it's different than it used to be, where it's very loud and shouting at you and confrontational in some ways. Whereas back in the day, I remember listening to a local guy and obviously national, like Dr. Ruth even, where people would call in with their problems, and they would, although not Dr. Ruth, but there'd be the soothing voice out there in the night trying to help them with their problems. And it was a very different type of experience. And I just thought, well, what if there was we had that kind of talk radio going on now with a breakout star? How would that be if she was being menaced and she had her own secrets she was hiding? But regarding the dual plots, something difficult to do at times. It's always very questionable to do because readers can decide to like one plot better than the other and let you know about it. But there was a kind of a carryover from the last book, Blood Truth, where Rick's embroiled with some very nasty characters, and they come back in this book to collect on a debt they feel he owes them, but of course he doesn't. But they're pretty bloodthirsty and have threatened him and those he loves. So they hire him, and I'm putting quotations about hiring, to follow someone or to stake out someone who, for their own reasons. And Rick also has a reputation, or not a reputation, but a past with the person he's hired to stake out, which leads to complications and violence even.
I know. It always
like I said, it's always dangerous to do that, but I felt I had to wrap up this part of the this part of the Rick's backstory in this book, and so I did it.
No, you really did it, and I got really nervous as you were doing it too. And I'm saying, oh my God,
okay,
is this going to really be over? And then when I realized, I said, well, you never know, because there's always more. Somebody can always come back. And you just don't know that they're back there. And is Moira and he have some kind of falling out, right, during this one? She doesn't, you know, I love her because she's not going to tolerate his, you know, his nonsense and his junk, and she's going to just let him have it. So at times, how come they have this, you know, love-hate relationship, and all of a sudden she says, don't call me anymore, I hate you, leave me alone.
Well, I can't say that when that happens. But, he's hard to deal with at times. Rick's hard to deal with. Like I said earlier, for him, the ends justify the means too much, and he's reckless in how he gets there at times. And she likes him, and she realizes his shortcomings and tries to help him with that. But sometimes even her patience is, of course, she's a little saucy anyway, but her patience is often tested by him. And, he breaks the law doing some things, and she can't tolerate that. That's not what she does. And it's not what she's about. She walks the line for sure, but she doesn't want to knowingly break the law. And dealing with Rick can put her in some very dicey situations, not only regarding the law, but also regarding her safety at times, which happens in this book.
Well, that's why I like him, because he doesn't play it straight all the time. I guess because, you know, if a character didn't have flaws, they would put me to sleep, seriously. You know how many books I've read? Too many. And when things go too smoothly, I go like, that's not going to happen. That would never be like that. They would be in some kind of danger. Something would have to happen. So if, you know, a murder is caught in 5 minutes, and I just, you know, finished something yesterday, and I'm saying, like, I knew who did that. I knew that on the first page. And it's that doesn't help when you write a review. Like, I figured it out right away. This one was really like, oh, my God, this is really scary. So when he goes to see Naomi, why does he want to get close to her? Why does he want him to stay with her? Because that was not, you know, sort of like inappropriate or whatever, but she refuses to be without Rick.
Oh, because she's like as I said earlier that she was left out of some of the decision making with management at the radio station. So she doesn't know the real depth of this character, perhaps. Plus, she's a little tougher than others may know because of her own background, which becomes apparent later in the book. But Rick wants they have a little falling out themselves, Rick and Naomi. And he's frustrated with her because her not telling him all the truth makes his job more difficult. And there's something that happens where he wonders if she's even being truthful at all with him, and if perhaps this whole Pluto thing is not as dangerous as it seems. And then when he realizes he's made a mistake, he gets frantic and he realizes that she is really in a lot of danger. And so he needs to get her to stay with him for a little bit while he figures out things, because he's afraid that Pluto actually knows where she lives. And after they've had this falling out, she doesn't, you know, she said, well, why do you believe me now? So there's a little bit of give and take with the two of them on that. But she eventually realizes that she needs to listen to him as best she can. And he not only has her at his house, but he also gets help from someone from an earlier book, a former kind of adversary of him from a former book, which was Dark Fishers, I think. Her name is Miranda, and she ends up helping Rick in that book. Mm-hmm. She actually saves his life in Dark Fishers, and she's a former MMA fighter who doesn't look the part, looks like the girl next door, but she's very tough and the best bodyguard Rick knows. So he gets Naomi to stay with her a little bit for protection.
She was in this one too, right? If I remember correctly, she was in this one.
Yes.
Yes, she was.
Rick's,
I like Miranda. You got to bring her back. I like her too. She can protect anybody, seriously.
Right.
And and what about the detectives in this particular case? Did the police ever get involved in this one? Before I ask more questions about Pluto, that's a cool name because Pluto is like supposedly the furthest planet away. But actually, I did some research and found out there are two more even farther away. Seriously, that they're looking into. So if anybody wants to, get really far away, you might consider Pluto wherever there's, nobody there. And it's a lot of ice, so I'm not sure if you want to go there. So who are the police officers and the detectives that handle this particular case, and do they take it seriously?
Well, they later take it seriously. They become involved tangentially because there's a missing persons case that Rick becomes involved in because he thinks he inadvertently was responsible for it by actions he took and by not going to the police because Naomi didn't want him to. So he feels responsible for this missing person. When Rick feels responsible for something, he has to get to the bottom of it. So he bumps heads against the detective on the case, Detective Scoopin, who thinks that Rick, being a private investigator, first of all, he knows his reputation because everybody in San Diego knows the reputation. This is the guy that probably got away with killing his wife. Plus, Rick's had a couple of high celebrity, he's had cases that have been in the news, and this guy thinks he's just out to get more celebrity, that he just wants it for the visibility, where that's the last thing Rick wants. He wants nothing to do with the press, but because he thinks he may partially be responsible for this person missing, and the fact that he thinks Pluto may be the person who abducted the missing person, he gets involved in the case, and he and Scoopin butt heads, of course. He butts heads with the police.
We get to know the media in every single book, so why is it that they make it more visual or more hype? Sometimes they deliver what's really there, and sometimes they deliver it. Every news channel delivers something different. So even in this particular case, we have a news reporter, Kathy Cade, and we have a whole bunch of reporters. How come the media hypes it up and makes it worse than it normally is? And then they incite the public, and then the public wants it streamed. Yeah.
there's so much competition now. You know, it used to be something like this. There might only be local media, and probably be only three stations in each city. And now there's multiple stations, and network can get involved, and 24-hour news cycles. So the competition for getting a story nowadays is crazy. So you have to make the story bigger than it is. Of course, you have to show that you've got the story, and that you know, we're on it 24/7, and it's huge. And in reality, it may not be huge. Of course, the story is kind of big, but yeah, the competition is fierce for getting the story first or making the biggest deal out of it. And of course, when you got a guy like Rick, who's got a bad reputation, he's sort of a hero and sort of an anti-hero in the news' eyes in many ways. That makes it all that more exciting for them.
Okay, so let's just tell us about Pluto without giving away who he is. We don't know if one in K there, but how did you create somebody that's out of his mind like that? He's totally insane, and we know that. And how come you chose the word Pluto? I mean, that means far out. He's talking all of another orbit, so I don't know. Why did you choose that, and how did you create somebody that's so seriously insane, and you get to think, oh, my God, he's crazy. I wouldn't want him to be me.
Well, Pluto is also the Roman god of the underworld. So when the program manager initially sees this guy's calling himself Pluto, he thinks exactly like you did. Well, why is he calling himself a planet? Blah blah blah. And so Rick digs a little deeper and realizes, well, he's the name is also for a Roman god and the god of the underworld. So Rick thinks, my God, this guy's the devil. He's calling himself the devil. That's pretty serious.
Yeah.
So I wanted there to be a little mystery about the name initially, and then they had to figure it out. The character, I don't know, I guess the characters always come from a little bit of the author. So maybe I'm insane, but maybe not that evil. I wanted to be a sociopath for some. Well, I'll tell you what. Part of the idea of how this character came together, it came from my friend Jeff Dobsett, who helped me with this book. He's been in sports talk radio in San Diego for 20 plus, or Southern California for 20 plus years, and he was telling me about because I asked him when I was thinking about writing about talk radio and making it. Kind of a stalker. I asked him, do you ever get any nasty mail or have a stalker? And he goes, yeah, it happens to everybody. And he said, I got this letter where it was written in, you know, in pen, but you could tell that the writer had written so hard on the envelope and on the pages that there was indentations into the back of the paper. So I thought, well, that is some real rage going on there. And it didn't really bother Jeff, which I thought was kind of funny, but I think it would bother the program director, and obviously bother another star if they realized it was going on. So I got that idea of this really seething anger, and I had to figure out where this anger came from, and I found the connection as the character grew for me, but I won't get into. But yeah, that's the other, that's, as I mentioned earlier, there's these, I think there's all, in addition to anonymity in the world, there's also people that want to be heard, and they take that anonymity and just say whatever the hell they want and can menace people without being without being revealed. And there's this culture of celebrity where everybody gets their 15 minutes, but some people, if they don't get their 15 minutes and they feel they need their 15 minutes, you know, if they're a little twisted to begin with, that can really warp into this sick need to be heard and to take out on the world what they think's been, you know, the wrongs they've been done to them.
It's scary because sometimes they just feel invisible, and then doing this, they're not invisible anymore, and they have like self-esteem and self-worth, and they need to feel, yeah, I know people like that. I have to get attention because no one else pays attention to me, so I'll just kill a few people and scare everybody.
Right, and there's more opportunity for attention nowadays that you feel the people that they feel like why am I shunned, and there's more opportunity to be heard but yet still be anonymous. So kind of a dangerous time that way with celebrities.
It is scary. It is scary, actually. So, I mean, you could have a radio show, like I do, like other people do, And how, when he contacts her, he talks to her on the radio, she doesn't realize that he's out of his mind? She just thinks he's another caller? She doesn't realize he's crazy? Because I would realize he's crazy.
Well, we don't hear his, when he's called her before the book opens, where he's probably made calls where he's just a normal caller, but he wants to be able to be heard on the radio and to hear her voice, be talked to directly. But later in the book, where he does actually declare himself as Pluto, he is obviously deranged. And on air, Naomi at this point is just kind of sick of it, and she wants to bring about a confrontation. So she challenges him with kind of dire consequences.
That's scary. But before I forget, and I don't want to forget, Thursday is the last show for this year, and I'm interviewing Stephen James, Every Wicked Man. On January 3rd, I got so excited. Today's been one of those days where I got excited. Oh, my God. Besides interviewing Matt Quayle, I am, like, excited because on January 3rd, Arthur Barfus Mark Cameron is coming on, and he writes for Tom Clancy. On the 14th, we've got Bo Wagner on Network Exposed. And Cindy McDonald, let's hope it goes well this time, and then the timer doesn't go off, the Fiona Quinn series. On the 8th, Pastor Michael Jones, we're going to talk about Begin to Serve. And on the 17th, we're going to do some controversial issues. We're going to talk about legalization of marijuana. We're going to talk about e-cigarettes and regulating them. And something that a lot of people have stopped me and asked me if I was going to do, so I'm going to do it anyway, the rising cost of health care, why Obamacare is being considered unconstitutional, and the rise of drugs. And I'm doing that with former FBI agent Michael Tabman. And that's just some part of January. And, of course, I was saying before the show, I'm really, extremely. And that's not even the 21st, the 23rd, and our new authors. We're going to talk about autism on one show. And on the 5th, Brian Freeman is coming out with the Crooked Street. And on the 11th, I'm doing it again. We're going to do a panel show with Dick Belsky, John Land, Alan Topol, Marcia Casper Cook, and Marilyn Levinson. We're going to talk about dialogue. And on the 10th of January, Vincent Zandri is coming on. I'm not sure if we're going to talk about a book, but he wants to talk about how the publishing industry has changed. And on February 13th, Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child versus For the Dead. And that's just some until February, and there's a whole lot more they tell me coming at me. But right now, let's get back to my favorite book for the year. Wrong Life has the trappings of a classic serial killer story, doesn't it? So why did you make it? How did you make it different? Because, you know, I've read over 9,000 books, seriously. My husband counted them on my computer. And I said, you got to be kidding me. He said, no, that's about right. Yeah, and there's a reason, but we're not going to get into why I read so much. But how did you make it so different? Because it's not typical of every book I've read. And usually when I open up a book and I go like, oh, my God, the same character again? Help me. Not with this one. So how did you do that?
Well, for me, obviously I'm writing a series. I'm writing in first person. So if you read the books, you're going to be in Rick Cahill's head the whole time.
Yeah.
So I wanted to have a sociopath in the book, but not told from a close third person, or not told in his voice, and not for him to take over the story, because the Rick Cahill books are really about Rick's journey and about Rick's quest for redemption. He feels responsible for his wife's murder, which happened before any of the books started, before the very first book, Yesterday's Echo. And everything from that incident has come the reverberations that have taken over his life. So he feels desperate for redemption, to try to redeem himself for how he feels responsible in his wife's death. And with each book, he gets maybe a little more manic in that need. And so when something like thus he also feels like when he's involved in a case emotionally, he really gets his teeth into it. And it takes over his life. And so when there's also the fact when someone's in need and he feels like he let his wife down when she was in need, that he really, really gets attached to the case. So I want it to be about Rick's growth or lack thereof and not about so much about the serial killer, but I wanted to obviously have that force, that pressure of the serial killer. So for me, it always starts with Rick. How is this book going to affect Rick? How can he inch his way towards redemption? When the reality is, if you were looking from the outside and the things that Rick has done over the books, mistakes he's made, but also where his heart's in the right place and things he has helped some people, that if you're a third party looking, you would say, hey, Rick, you're redeemed. It's okay now. You can stop. It's all right. But internally, he'll never feel that. So when I'm writing Rick, I think about all the things that have happened to him physically and emotionally and all the scars he has. So every decision he makes is because of what's happened to him in the past. So sometimes he makes bad decisions that may not make sense. But if you know Rick, the character, you can realize why he made that bad decision.
Yeah, I agree with you.
So that's why I want to be more Rick than more serial killer.
He's overly guilty at times in his heart. So would he ever talk to somebody and get some help and realize that, you can't harp on it forever? I know we all feel like that. I mean, everybody has an incident in their life and they go like, if I had done this differently, maybe this would have turned out a different way. And you can't say what if all the time. So sometimes, you need somebody. Would he talk to somebody? Would anybody straighten him out? Or would he just like keep going and just figure he'll get past it by himself?
You know, it's a great question. That's a great question that I've been asked before. You know, why isn't Rick in therapy? He should be in therapy, clearly. But I don't know. He justifies his own existence in various ways. He justifies some of the violence in his life in various ways. But he definitely should be in therapy 4 times a week. But he lets a little, with more, with Moira, he lets a little out here and there. And if he has a love interest, he lets tiny bits out. But I don't know if we'll ever really have that big discussion he needs, but he definitely should.
I don't know if he wants to form a regular love interest either, but you have to get it past me first because he'll have to get the clipboard test to see if she fits the requirements. Seriously. No, that's
well,
just something
also,
my sister invented.
The one woman he loves, deepest was his wife, and he screwed that relationship up. And then she was murdered, and so he's also a little bit. Well, if I bring someone into this existence that I live, will they be damaged not only by me but from outside influences? So he may never get in a good relationship.
That's
he does have
scary.
A dog, though.
I like.
He's not a complete loser. He does have a dog, and they have a good relationship. So
that is good. I have a question that I really thought this was really cool. Rick lives by his late father's code. Sometimes you have to do what's right, even when the law says it's wrong. See, he's definitely a firm believer in that. That's exactly right. So why does he adopt this, and how does that get him into trouble? Because there are times when all of us feel, I know it's the right way to do things, but in order to get it done, I might have to push a little harder. So why does he adopt what his father said? Because that's not a bad thing. Well, maybe it is. Not to me, anyway.
Yeah, well, when he started investigating his father later in Blood Truth, he came to wonder if his father had really concentrated more on the wrong than the right, and then he also wondered about himself whether maybe he's taken it to the extreme. But he's got this manic need to find the truth in the matter, and that his father's credo fits perfectly for that desire. So he doesn't. If he tries to follow the rules, the police generally aren't going to help him that much anyway, because they think he's a bad guy. And so in some ways he's left to his own means, but it's very conscious when he's breaking the law that he knows he's doing wrong, but sometimes you have to do what's right even when the law says it's wrong. And he doesn't let it bother him that much, because the law, the rules, they're just in the way of him doing what he feels is the right thing and getting to the truth of the matter. But he does step back and at times and think, wonder about, maybe I'm on the wrong track here, because isn't this how despots are born? By thinking their right is the only right, and their means are the only means. But it doesn't stop him.
You know what I didn't realize? I was on my phone. My phone is, like, attached to me, plus my Facebook wall is right here. And I realized that when I got Blood Truth, and then I got this one, that I had reviewed Night Fishers. I didn't even realize. I said, oh, my God, I've read just about everything. Night Tremors I read, and my doctor has that one. I give away a book, it's not going to, they think it's fantastic, so that's why Sarah's getting this one right after it. So, which characters would you say are staples for these books, and which ones would you ever, this is a question I've asked John Land and Alan Topol and a few other, and Daniel Palmer. Daniel Palmer just wrote Saving Megan. If people want to read something fantastic, you got to read it. I read that yesterday, and it's not coming out till April. I literally couldn't put it down. He does standalones, and he never brings back the villain. Do you ever bring back your villain in a book? Would you ever bring back anyone that we don't know what happened to, or we think we know what happened to in a book? Because a lot of people bring back their villain, like James Patterson does, and that scares the daylights out of you.
Well, I sort of brought back a villain in Blood Truth with Peter Stone, who menaces Rick in the first book, Yesterday's Echo. He was brought back in Blood Truth, and he and Rick in some ways have to work together in that, for a certain situation in that book, which was fun and interesting. But hopefully I kill off enough villains, but obviously with my books, I'm not averse to bringing back anybody. I've had Moira in 3 or 4 books now, and Turk Muldoon makes an occasional appearance, and a love interest, Kim, was in 3 or 4 books. So there is a little community. This guy does live in a little community. He doesn't have many friends, but so the ones he has, it's not bad for him to stay close to them. And I bring his dog back.
Well, this was... So, what's coming next? And when am I getting it? And then I'm going to talk about the title and how you came up with Wrong Light, because that's a really cool title.
Thanks. excuse me. Right now, I'm just finishing. It's due at the end of the month. What is now entitled, and I think the title will stay, Lost Tomorrows. And in this book, Rick learns the truth about what happened to his, learns the who killed his wife. I'll say that.
Oh, good.
So there's that. So that, a lot of complications ensue. So it's the first book that I've written where Rick's not centered in San Diego the whole time. He's in Santa Barbara most of the time, which was a different experience for me because I like to be in the city I write in. And I made some trips to Santa Barbara. I went to school there 1,000 years ago, but I made a few trips up there to get the sense, the ambience of how it is now. But I do like writing in the area I live, so I can just get in the car and go investigate an area and get ideas and stuff. So it's hard to do it remotely. But the title, Wrong Light, for me, it's funny because I just said the title of the next book, Lost Tomorrows, which came to me soon, the soonest the title's ever come to me. Because titles generally, I don't worry about the title when I'm writing the book. I know some authors start with the title, and that influences the book itself. I wish I could do that, but I have to, the title comes organically for me as I'm writing the book. And sometimes, almost always, it will come actually from a sentence in the story. So, however, I will say that, well, first of all, Wrong Light makes sense in a lot of ways where, it comes in the book about a particular villain. Is he seen in the wrong light? But in actuality, there's Rick. Is Rick in the wrong light? Is he seen in the wrong light? It kind of makes sense throughout. But I will say a quick aside. So my first book, Yesterday's Echo, it came organically from the book, and the publishers liked, all of a sudden they liked 2-word titles. So I had to come up in the next book, book 2, I had to come up with a 2-word title, and I had a really bad title that I sent off to them when I sent the book. And this, I've worked on this book for 18 months, this Night Tremors, and I didn't have a title the whole time. I had a crappy title. And so my publisher says, well, this stinks. I said, I know. What do you have? And they said, what do I have? You need to give me a title, and I need it in the next couple of days. And so all of a sudden, after working on this book for 18 months, the title came to me in 5 minutes, Night Tremors. So it was nice to be able to focus the mind and have it come. But, yeah, generally they come – or well, not generally. They always come organically from the writing. But condensing everything down to two words has made it a interesting test. A nice little test. But so far we're okay.
I just did a panel show with a whole bunch of people, like I said, and we talked about characters, and this was hilarious, I'll tell you. Deciding, how did you decide on the name Rick Cahill, and how did you decide on what he does? Because that was the question I asked John Land, Alan Topol, Dick Belsky. We talked about each of the cats. How did you decide what he does? And would you ever write a standalone? And one of your questions is it scary to write one that has no Mikhail on it?
Regarding his name, there is a story to that.
Initials
are RC. The initials are RC for a reason. Because, mm-hmm. of course, I read everything Raymond Chandler wrote when I was young, and I'm a huge Raymond Chandler fan. So I wanted it to be a little hat tip for Raymond Chandler. And I also wanted it to be, being myself of Irish descent, I wanted the name to have some connection to from Irish descent, and Cahill does, although it's also other descendants. And I wanted a hard C. I wanted Rick Cahill. I wanted to have this kind of staccato to it. And thus I finally mm-hmm. found the name. I came up with the name and, writing a standalone, excuse me. Yeah, I'm definitely going to write something different very soon. It may be a new series. It may be a standalone. I want to write Rick for as long as I can, as long as people want to read him,
mm-hmm.
but I do need to write something new as well.
Well, that is exciting. I mean, I was talking about to that with, about the Chase Baker series that Vincent Zanry wrote. And he was telling me that he has a new book coming out in April. And the problem is that because he writes independent, they told him that if he wants to put this particular book published, he has to give up the independent. So I felt kind of like that's not fair. Because I like, you know, I've read everything he wrote, all 90,000 books of them. So we'll see what happens. But the Chase Baker series for YAs and the Shroud Key, the first one in the adult, they're really good, seriously. So, you know, you have to see what happens. And Ocean View Publishing, you're with the best publishers in the world. They keep me very busy, seriously. I mean, I never know what's going to come. And, yeah, last week a few more came, and I've got a bag full of a whole bunch of them. So where can describe, if Rick were here, if we could speak, what would he say about himself? And what would he say about, you know, you writing him in? Would he add something? Would he want to change his character? Would he want to add something to him? If he could speak to people, I would love to talk to him. He's interesting.
He probably wouldn't say much. He'd be internalizing angst. He probably would ask me to write less about him. I think that, you know, keep his name out of the papers. Just leave him alone, and please don't hire him. Because if you hire him, you're liable to get hurt. And things will come out that you didn't want to come out. And hopefully it makes for a good reading, but a pretty, pretty miserable life.
Well,
but I love him.
I know. And I love him too. He's great because he, you know, no holds barred. That's what makes him so great. And what about Moira? What would she say about herself?
I want to just kind of add, before I answer that, I want to add to what you said about Ocean View,
okay.
Because they've been really good to me, and I really appreciate what they do for me. They're really good people over there. Moira would probably say, she'd probably correct me for sure. Tell me what I'd done wrong and how I could do it better. And she would, I think that's probably about it. And she would, yeah, she'd probably get me on a better in my life, which is probably much needed. I could use a little Moira in my life, I think.
I think everyone could use a little Moira in your life because she sort of centers
yeah.
everybody. seriously,
right.
Seriously speaking. But I'm not going to say anything about the ending of the book. But you came up with a surprise ending in this book. How did you create that so that I wouldn't figure out what happened? And like I said, I read a book yesterday, and I was like, "Are you serious?" Yeah. And I was asked to read one that I'm kind of like, won't say what it is. It's kind of like, I can't believe that the author of the book didn't get arrested for all the pranks that he played and all the things that he did. And it's a true story. It's about Watergate. And I'm saying, like, it's really funny. I mean, some of the things that he pulled, he had a streak of in front of Ed Muskie, and it's a true story. And the girl actually did this, and she was stupid for $20. So, yeah, there's a whole bunch of books that I get like, are you kidding me? Oh, my God. And, I was specifically asked to read this. So, I mean, what about this? We wouldn't change anything about Rick or anything like that, would you? You'll keep him the same way?
Yeah, and endings can be hard and they can be easy. It's hopefully you...
Yeah.
The hardest thing for me about writing mysteries is the plotting and giving mm-hmm. enough information to the reader for them to feel like you're not cheating them, and also not necessarily withholding. See, but when you're writing in first person, you can withhold because you only see what the protagonist sees, and Rick sometimes is wrong in his assumptions, which can lead to trouble. So, and sometimes mm-hmm. if the reader is... Hopefully you've given the reader enough information where they may realize at one point, wait a sec, Rick, you're on the wrong track here. And he, because of his internal problems, maybe can't see he's on the wrong track. And if the reader sees that he's wrong, I'm fine with that. That's good. But if they don't and they're right in his head, that's good too. But you want the ending to make sense for the rest of the book. You know,
mm-hmm.
so you obviously want
good.
A big ending and everything to make sense. It has to be true to what's gone on before. And this particular ending was one of my favorites because of, where it can lead and where it's led me in the next book. That's all I'll say.
All I could tell you is that I said, oh, my God. You know, writing in the first person is the only way I can write. It's scary. And I'm very excited if I ever get done this week because they're waiting for me to finish it. Silenced Voices is the title of my next book, and my characters are all dead. Everyone knows.
Oh, wow. It's a great title.
I came up with that because all the people in this book have been silenced by someone that did something to them, or they did something to someone, and they deserve to be silenced. The first two stories are based on real-life incidents, but I sort of changed it. And the last four are my crazy imagination. So I'm hoping to finish it. I just finished a book called Golden State by Ben Winters, and he wrote the book is about if you tell a lie, you get arrested, and what happens throughout the book and what happens to him at the end was scary. So I think my last story is going to be about a world where somebody lives, and if they tell the truth, they wind up dead. I just have to... It's my Faces Behind the Stone series, and I'm hoping there's a regular publisher, I won't say which one, that said that he would read it. That doesn't mean he's going to take it, but at least it's a start. So I'm excited.
Yeah, good luck.
So it's interesting, and I'm going to ask people to read it so that I can get an idea of what people think, because Brian Friedman and John Land and a few others gave me blurbs for the last couple, and... The last one I wrote was called A Daughter's Promises, My Promise Never to Put My Mom in a Nursing Home. And people have been taking it as a resource because she had Alzheimer's. And it's her words.
Yeah, that's rough.
Indefinitely. Yeah, it's scary. So where can we learn more about you and your work? And when am I getting the next one? And when is it coming out? Because I have to put it in my schedule of 9,000 books to read. There's 20 on my chair right now.
9,001. MattCoyleBooks.com is my website. I'm not that active on social media, but I'm really active on Facebook. That's the one place I'm active. Just Matt Coyle, you'll find me there. If you look me up, you'll find many pictures of my dog Angus on the couch. That's how I'm known on Facebook, basically. Occasional something about my writing, and then 15 pictures of Angus sleeping in various positions. And then I'm on Twitter at CoilM, where I know how to retweet, and that's about it. But I do like getting tweets.
No, I know how to tweet. I learned too much. I'm on LinkedIn and everywhere else. And I just read this before. I got over 3,000 people, for whatever reason, on LinkedIn that connect with me. And I have no idea why, but yeah, and every time I connect with someone, they ask me if I could read their book, and I don't always answer because I don't read everything. But I want to thank you so much. I'm so excited that this show finally happened. And yeah,
I have to tell you,
Blog Talk Radio did apologize for what happened that time. They said it was their problem, that it wasn't me messing up.
Oh.
And Cindy McDonald, January 16th, the timing will be perfect. I've been checking the shows every day to make sure it says 120 minutes. I don't know what happened. But thank you so much. I'm excited, and I can't wait to read the next one. If sun is shining,
thanks for having me. Yeah, I forgot
beautiful.
To tell you, the next one should come out. The next one should come out in December of next year. So December of 19, I think.
And I hope I get to finally meet you coming to the Thriller Fest, because I was invited. They invite me.
I am not going to Thriller Fest unless something happened where I was nominated for something, and then I would go. It's a long trip.
I wish I could do that. They won't let me do it because I have better idea. My awards matter, yeah. And I nominate the right people. They should. And maybe I'll tell Kimberly.
I'm very happy to get... Very, very happy to get the award that you gave me. I appreciate that.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Everybody, it's a beautiful day outside. It's 28 degrees here. I don't know how it is where you are, but I'm freezing. And have a great day, and bye.